Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. You're tuned in to Columbo Chronicles at Blog Talk Radio. Follow the mover and shaker, award-winning author and host, seen on TV and radio, Rose Columbo. Every Wednesday, Rose interviews prominent experts and authors on politics and social justice. Call in and listen or ask the guests a question at 646-564-9742. Now, here's Rose.
Hello, everyone. Hi. Glad you joined us. And you're tuned in to Columbo's Chronicles live at the Blog Talk Radio Network with the Rose Columbo. Thank you for listening and sharing. And as our numbers are growing and increasing, I just want to thank you and appreciate it so much. And tonight, we're not talking so much about politics. Sometimes we just have to take a little break. But we're going to have a little more fun tonight because we're all about education, information, and entertainment. And tonight it's more entertainment. And we're going to have a really special guest coming up in just a little while. She's a popular author. Her name is Judy Watson. And she wrote a fabulous book called Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. And she has untold stories. And she's going to share them right here on Columbo Chronicles Live with you and me. So I don't know about you, but I can't wait. I have a cup of hot tea and hope you have a nice cup of hot tea or coffee and sit back and relax. It's rather funny today and strange and odd, but we're going to be talking about the classic motion picture and the original movie stars that we love so much, and we continue to watch their movies as it's passed down from generation to generation. I have a whole library of DVDs with the classic old movies, and I just can't get enough. I just love them. And they're passed down to the children, to the grandchildren. You can just keep passing them on down. They're going to love them, too. My kids, I got them hooked on them. I got my grandkids hooked on them. It's fantastic. So it's really amazing today because the Hollywood actors and actresses, they're all speaking out about politics, expressing their political opinions in all sorts of ways, whether it's threatening the president and the White House, and or it's threatening the Trump supporters or whatever it is. They have their opinions, and they're speaking out on the stage when they get those awards. But however, that's what America's all about. It's the good old red, white, and blue, good old USA. Thank God we're here and we can speak out. Thank God that there are Americans standing up to stop any foreign enemies from trampling on our sovereignty and our Constitution, and especially our right to speak up and speak out, whether it's in the media, whether it's on a public sidewalk, whether it's a protest or a march. That's what makes America great, because we can still express our opinions and our thoughts and create. We can create movies. So what about the history of Hollywood located in California? Since we're going to be talking with our guest in just a little bit, I thought I'd pull up a little bit about the history of Hollywood. And you can find this on ushistory.com if you want to read more about it. But just a few tidbits here. Hollywood was established in 1853 with a single adobe hut on land outside Los Angeles, California. Growing crops was so successful there that by 1870, Hollywood became a thriving agricultural community. One of its most notable historic figures was the real estate tycoon Harvey Henderson Wilcox and his wife, Ida, who moved to Los Angeles from Topeka, Kansas in the 1880s. Wilcox, having lost the use of his legs from a bout with typhoid fever prior to moving out west, bought 160 acres of land west of the city at the foothills near the Cahunga Pass. The town's name came from Di-Ida, who, while on a train trip, she was going east, and she met a woman that described her country home in Ohio that had been named for the Dutch settlement of Hollywood. Liking the name, Di-Ida christened their ranch Hollywood upon her return. On February 1, 1887, Wilcox submitted a grid map of his new town to the Los Angeles County Recorder's Office. This was the first official document with the name Hollywood printed on it. The first street in town was named Prospect Avenue, but was later changed to Hollywood Boulevard, where the city lots were carved out around dirt avenues and pepper trees. At one time, the English holly was planted in the area, but it didn't survive amid the arid climate. By 1900, Hollywood had a population of 500, a post office, a newspaper, a hotel, and two markets in neighboring Los Angeles through 7 miles of orange groves. The population reached 100,000. There was a single-track streetcar line that twisted its way along Prospect Avenue on an irregular schedule into the city on a 2-hour trip. Things have changed, haven't they? By 1902, the first portion of the famous Hollywood Hotel was built, and a new trolley car system was installed in 1904, cutting the travel time dramatically. Can you imagine how excited they were? The system was called the Hollywood Boulevard, and we all know Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard, right? Due to its ongoing struggles to maintain an adequate water supply, residents voted to have Hollywood annexed by the city of Los Angeles and its new aqueduct system. In the early 1900s, filmmakers began moving to the Los Angeles area to get away from the strict rules imposed by Thomas Edison's Motion Picture Patents Company that was located in New Jersey. Since most of the movie-making patents were owned by Edison, did you know that? I didn't know that either. Independent filmmakers were often sued by Edison to stop their productions. So, to escape Edison's control, and because of the ideal weather conditions and the varied terrain, movie makers began to arrive in Los Angeles to make their films. If agents from Edison's company came out west to find and stop these filmmakers, adequate notice allowed for a quick escape to Mexico. Working without disturbance from Edison, the Biograph Company moved west with actors Blanche Sweet, Lillian Gish, Mary Pickford, Lionel Barrymore, and others to make their films. After beginning filming in Los Angeles, the company decided to explore the neighboring area and stumbled across Hollywood. Biograph made the first film in Hollywood entitled In Old California. After hearing of Biograph's praise of the area, other filmmakers headed west to set up shop. So it's very interesting because no one really thinks about where did this all begin. And there's a lot more to it, and it's very, very interesting to see how our country began, and then, of course, Hollywood's big, and everybody loves the movies, and everybody loves the movie stars, so it's really exciting to have a wonderful guest that will be joining us this evening to share her popular book, which is Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. So right now we're going to take a break, and I will be back in just a moment. So, hey, don't touch that dial. Stay with us.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Columbo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Columbo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to columbochronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Columbo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, columbochronicles.com.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
Yes, be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe. And now we're going to introduce our guest. And our wonderful guest is Judy Watson. And she wrote the wonderful popular book, Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. So why don't we just get started and say hello to Judy Watson. Hi, Judy. How are you this evening?
Hey, Rose. I'm fine. And I was listening to your introduction, and I was the book is called Wings and Other Recollections, but the original title was Hitching Post on Vine Street, 1919, and that was Dick's way of talking about what he saw when he came into Hollywood, which is very similar to what you were saying. And he writes, in the early 20s, Vine Street was a curbless dirt road lined with beautiful pepper trees from the hills above Hollywood to the door of famous player Lasky Studio, later to become Paramount. It was all so rural, an oil well pumped away in the middle of La Cienega Boulevard and all the way to Fox Studios on Western Avenue, a distance of 5 miles. The streets were bordered with lemon, avocado, fig, and orange trees. Hollywood was an overgrown market basket, and anybody could literally and figuratively help himself to the fruit. So that's really interesting when you go back and think about how it all started.
How different it was, and there was so much more agricultural, so much more land, and fewer people, too. And so, welcome, Judy. Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live. And what in the world made you change the title then to Wings?
That's very interesting. I think basically my son, who is a writer, said to me, well, first of all, I thought, well, of Wings. And then he said, no, Mom, add early recollections of Hollywood. Because what I did was take those memories of Dick's, which were recollections of how it really was, how it felt. He lived there and what it was like. And the feedback I've gotten from so many people was, gee, I never knew that was that way, and I never knew that existed. But in the beginning, he wanted it to be called a hitching post at Vine Street because the cowboys lived up in the hills, you know. And that's how Hollywood began, with Western movies. And they were
yes,
one
and
two reelers.
Yes, and just so people know a little bit about you, Judy Watson, you were born in Chicago. And,
I was.
Yes, and it says that you lived in the realm of creativity and the arts, and you studied writing at Arizona State University, and you've written short stories and presented a small narrative in history, and that your brother was an illustrator in film, TV, and your husband was an award-winning TV cameraman, and your son is presently a writer and executive producer at DreamWorks, while your daughter is a gifted artist and photographer who worked in animation. So it also says when your mother left hidden photographs, books, letters, manuscripts, tapes, and diaries to Watson, that you knew she needed to make this compelling, that you needed to make this compelling firsthand look inside the golden age of Hollywood available to the public. So when you talk about Wings, why don't you explain a little bit of the background to the audience about your mother and Dick and how this came into being, this book, Wings?
Well, it took me a while. I'm going to be very honest here. It took me a while on how to do the book, and the reason was it was all about Richard. I found the tapes, took them in, put them on CD because I wanted to verify for myself what I was reading. Was this his narrative? Was this his memoir? And there it was. I mean, I could literally read a page and go down that page when he's talking about how famous players Lasky became Paramount Studio and how he felt about it. And it was word for word. So I knew I had hit the jackpot. What I didn't know how to do was put my mother into the book. There is nothing of my mother in the entire book. And yet, she devoted 20 years of her life to this book. And I just thought, this is the least I can do. And for him, too, because Dick was a 50-year veteran of Hollywood. 50 years. He came into Hollywood in 1919. He makes Wings, which will become the first Academy Award-winning movie ever, in 1927. It will make him a star. And he will work for 50 more years. He will work on Broadway. He will work Playhouse 90 when television comes in. He will do stage, local stage, and radio shows. And he just had this long, long career. And I really knew nothing about that. I knew him through my mother. They were lovers. And it was it wasn't a secret, but in Hollywood, in those days, she was like the other woman because his third wife wouldn't give him a divorce. So he and mother were together, but it was like hidden. Odd to think of that in this world today, right? But
seriously,
I know. Yeah, I mean,
times
right.
have changed.
Yeah, well, we're going back to the 60s, 1960s. And so I found so much when I, you know, when Mom was dying, I found all these manuscripts. She actually did try to sell it, but if you can recall, people don't understand. In the old days, you couldn't get a book published unless you had an agent. And if you didn't have an agent, and how do you get an agent, then there wasn't going to be any book. And she, I have a whole file of her rejection notices. She actually knew how to write, but she didn't know how to put anything together. And so there was no chronological sequence to the stories. And it slowly evolved in my head that the best way to do this would be to do it by the decades of his life. He's born at the beginning of the 20th century. So that's perfect. And when he comes to Hollywood, we're in the second, he's in his 20s, it's now 1919, and he gets a start as a messenger boy and finds himself doing bit parts and small things. And he has some friends, and finally the picture Wings, that's quite a story about Wings, is decided to be made. Do you want me to talk about Wings? Or?
Well, I do want you to talk about Wings. We're talking about Richard Arlen and Maxine Coolidge and how this book came into being with Judy
yeah.
Watson, the daughter of Maxine Coolidge. And so Wings was actually a silent movie and in the Library of Congress, right?
It is probably the last great silent film ever made. And it was put in, I think, 1997, I was reading, it went into the Library of Congress because of what it was and what it did. And what it's really a remarkable film, the more I've studied it, the more I've come to know. And what my mother had in her possession, and I don't think she even understood it, was a brochure. There was a group called the Cross and Cockade, and they were all World War One, absolutely in love with aviation, and they absolutely loved Richard Arlen because he could fly. He actually could fly an airplane. He was a pilot. He actually ran a school in World War II over in Van Nuys at the Burbank Airport. And he was this man that they just adored. So in 1968, they did a one-night retrospective of the film. Okay. And when they went to Paramount, Paramount had lost everything. They didn't have a picture. They didn't have a still. They didn't have even, I think they had to find the film in vaults, redo the film. And they put together this complete history, and I've never found it anywhere else. And they put it into a brochure, which they gave to Paramount. And my mother had a copy. And I took this brochure, and my son said, you know, Mom, give him credit. So I did. And this is the complete history from beginning to end of the movie. And I'm going to say one of the great heroes for me is Jesse Lasky, who kind of goes down and disappears in the history of filmmaking. But it is Jesse Lasky's idea to make this picture. And he goes to the War Department, and he asks them to help them. You know, one of the things that was happening in this country around that period, we didn't have an Air Force. World War One. That was, Dick ran away to Canada. That's where he learned to fly an airplane, and he came back to this country. We were still trying to create an Air Force. So Lasky goes to the War Department, and he says, can we make this picture? We want to make this picture in the air. It's never been done. And we want to ask you if you will participate and help us. And they're so happy to do that, that he goes out, and that's where the film was shot, in San Antonio, Texas. And it shot, it says here, I was reading on Wikipedia that they said there were no extras. These were the men that were there in the Air Force that were used in the films. There were no stuntmen. All the flying was real, done by real pilots. you could never do this again, ever.
That is amazing.
I know. It was really, you know, I know, think about it. It doesn't matter what it costs. This would never be done again. Imagine getting the Army to make a picture for you using their men. So the battle sequences that are seen in those shots that they created in the movie, those are real soldiers that they used who were there at San Antonio. And
well,
then they brought,
go
ahead.
Oh, go ahead. They brought what?
No, they just, the expertise that was brought in was really just, they brought in William Wellman to do the directing because he had been a pilot in World War I in Europe. And he was known as Wild Bill, and he was really terrific. So it evolved into a wonderful and unique film that had never, they'd never seen the likes of it before.
Well, you do give Jesse Lasky a very good compliment, excellent compliment. You say he's the genius behind both movies and a real pioneer of the industry, and that these two films, The Virginia and The Virginian and Wings, revolutionized the film industry. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the importance of The Virginian?
Well, what's interesting to note is that, okay, Wings is made 1927. It plays all over the world. It plays for 2.5 years. By the time Wings ends, it's 1929, and silent films are gone, and they're not going to return. They're over. And Lasky recognizes that, and he decides to make a Western with an actual story. Though Westerns were the backbone of the early days of Hollywood, there were no stories. They would just, you know, go out, shoot someone up, and come back. And he finds a wonderful story, and it has a moral and a fable. And he just says, this will change the way Westerns are made forever. And it does. And it also makes a great star out of Gary Cooper. It's Gary Cooper's introduction. You know, people put down that he was in Wings. Well, he has a little tiny part in Wings. He was good, but, you know, that was it. No, The Virginian establishes sound, and sound side the studio. I mean, you have to think about it. Sound's brand new. They're just starting it. It's all done inside a studio where they can control, you know, outside sounds, internal sounds, voices. But the risk of making sound in its very early birth outside, well, that's what they do. They go up into the Sierra Madre Mountains, and they make The Virginian. And it's, to me, that is absolutely remarkable. And one of the things I read somewhere was that for years, it's on YouTube, it's free. And it's for years, though, it was a very poor production because of all the outward sound. They took the picture, they redid it, and it's, you can see the entire picture, and it's just remarkable to watch what is now, you know, we accept, but what was so absolutely new at that time.
That probably set off the studios to start making more Westerns because Westerns were very, very popular up until maybe like the 70s. They were extremely popular with the American people.
Well, even if we take in the 70s and we go and look at Clint Eastwood, how did he get a start? Rowdy Yates, and wasn't it Wagon Train? Well, we all watched Westerns. They were part and parcel. I'm not sure how they got I think they got replaced by doctor shows, but that's too bad because if you think about it, some of the great, great movies are Westerns because they tell a parable, they tell a story. But I'm also going to bring up something, too, about The Virginian, which I thought this is Owen Wister was the writer. And what's remarkable about the character is that he has no name. He is only known by the name The Virginian. Now, think about Clint Eastwood. I always do. He makes those Westerns. He comes into a town. He's this guy that saves everybody, but he has no name, you know. Then he rides out of the town. And
that's true.
And I thought,
But we like to look at him.
Right. But wasn't that really what the, and well, we looked, Gary Cooper was one of the most beautiful young men
he's gorgeous, I've ever seen.
I know.
It's so funny you say that, because I got my daughters hooked on the old classics, and they're always, oh, who's that? Who's that? I mean, they just think they're the most gorgeous men they've ever seen, you know. And, you know, they were the ones that are still living, but the ones who have passed, they were absolutely gorgeous.
Dick writes that in early Hollywood, you know, when they would pick them for the silent movies, that was the basis of how you were picked, your looks. And the more beautiful you were, the more valuable you were. And what really changed everything with sound. And in the picture, The Virginian, Gary Cooper was an unknown. They didn't know if they could bank on him. They didn't know how he would speak. They knew Dick had a good voice, so he was okay. He was trustworthy. They brought in Walter Houston. That is one of my favorite chapters in the book. And Walter Houston came out of the Broadway stage. And again, I'm going to give Jesse Lasky the congratulations here, because he had been in vaudeville. He knew that those people who were on the stage had presence, had voices, and could act. So Walter Houston is brought into Hollywood and, you know, given the job of being the villain, which he does, in The Virginian. And in the beginning, Gary Cooper doesn't want anything to do with him. You know, he's very threatened. But they all become very good friends. And one of the parts of Dick I really love, and about all his stories, is that he's just a nice, kind man. I mean, he genuinely is. And he becomes, his friendships last him throughout his life. And I think that's why he lasted as long as he did working in Hollywood. Because if you work in the industry, and that's all I really know from being around it through my son, who began as an actor, and all his friends, and Dick, is that you don't last in Hollywood unless you're the likable person, you know. Unless you, you can have your ego, but you're not gonna have a long career. And,
exactly. That's so true. And Judy, I'm going to let you take a little break here. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back in just a moment. And because I want to ask you who was Walter Houston, so don't touch that dial. We're going to be back with Judy Watson and her wonderful book, Wings and Other Reflections of Early Hollywood. So we'll be right back after this important message.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics, from politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up, Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc, Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Columbo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Columbo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to columbochronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Columbo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, we're back on Columbo Chronicles Live, and we're with Judy Watson, and she's our special guest with her popular book, Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. And we've been talking about Hollywood and its beginnings, and she's been explaining stories about Gary Cooper and the Virginian and about the silent movie Wings. Now she's going to talk to us a little bit and answer the question, who was Walter Houston? So, Judy, who was Walter Houston?
That's interesting, because if I said the name John Houston to you, you would have no trouble recognizing the name. John Houston
exactly.
was the son of Walter Houston. And whenever I think of Walter Houston, because honestly, I didn't know. I mean, he talks about him. He starts in vaudeville. He becomes a Broadway actor. He comes out to Hollywood. He makes movies. That's how Dick meets him. Goes back to Broadway, and he becomes famous and has a wonderful career. But it's his son, John, that people think about. And so if you want to think about who was Walter Houston, think of a little picture called The Treasure of Sierra Madre. Do you remember that picture with Humphrey Bogart? One of those
yeah.
marvelous pictures. John Houston was the director. Do you remember the crazy old man who dances in the fire? That
yeah.
was Walter Houston.
That
okay. was his father. That was his father. And
amazing.
He could do anything. Dick writes of him as being an actor with just the ability to play villains, heroes. I mean, just an amazing actor. And he has, John has a daughter named Angelica Houston. She's gone on to be an actress. And she does voiceovers. I know that because she's worked with my son in a cartoon that he's been doing. And she's a very lovely person. So the Houston family really is a long acting family in Hollywood. Just they've been around for a long, long time. And I love the chapter on Walter Houston. I had no idea he started in burlesque, but that is how he started, which is the way I think Lasky started. A lot of them started in burlesque, and then they found their way out to Hollywood. And that's why I think they were all so clever, knowing how to do things, you know.
Well, they had to be a lot more creative back then, too, because they didn't have all the modern props and the high-tech, you know, microphones and lighting and all of that. So they had to be really, you know, knowledgeable about what they were doing and clever and creative. And
there were
so,
no stuntmen,
you know. No, so, I mean, it's really amazing the wonderful movies that they made because they're still on DVD and they're still, you know, popular with young people whose parents, you know, introduce them to those classic movies. And generation after generation loves them. So what about the history of the studios, and where in the heck did agents come from?
That's interesting. Well, I think that was Selznick. Dick writes that he was the first one to have an agent. You know, basically, I mean, he writes, I found the material, and he writes about the makings of all the studios and how they all began. But they became so powerful that I think it was in the 40s that the Supreme Court steps in and they say, you're monopolizing everything, because they not only owned the studios, they owned the actors, they owned the theaters. And so the monopoly was broken up. And it's at this, around this period, or before this period actually, that agents begin to arrive. And I think the man's name is Myron Selznick, and he's a relation of David Selznick. And Dick was one of the first actors to ever have an agent. Because in the old days, the way you got a part was you got into the studio. You could, you know, they were very small. Everyone knew everyone. You got to know the casting directors, and that's how you were cast for a part. And then your salary was given to you according to what the studio thought your value was. And a lot of actors, especially Mary Pickford, you know, Doug Fairbanks, they wanted to be independent. They wanted to control things themselves. And so it begins that the agents come in and Hollywood begins to change. And I don't know, I've often had mixed emotions because on the one hand, the actor had the knowledge of having that tremendous safety with that contract with that studio. But on the other hand, Dick writes about several parts that he lost because he was under contract and the studio wasn't angry with someone else who owned the other studio, so they wouldn't lend him out. And this was also a part and parcel of the problem, too. And the actors
That's like
were,
people were property of the studio.
Yes, that's what he writes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
yeah, and if,
many,
you did, if they broke their contracts, I would assume that that was the end of them.
Well, not exactly. I think Gary Cooper is able to do so, but he's clever, he's young, he's wanted, and he knows where he's going to go before he gets out of one contract. But that's the beginning of how it's now the 30s, and agents are coming about, and things are changing. And there's a feeling, I think, in Dick's mind, and he writes about it, of loss, you know, of the loss of the glamour, the loss of the Hollywood, you know, the lights, the glowing lights, the feeling that Hollywood was something that went on forever and it was beautiful. And now, of course, you had an agent. You could go out and make your own deals. And with that comes, there's a lot of fear also in being completely independent because you can be let go. You can lose an agent if you don't work. You know, I don't know.
Well,
there's something to be.
And then they had to worry about unscrupulous agents too, you know, ripping them off or managers. You know, we heard
that,
about those stories too. That was a problem too.
Yeah, you do wonder. And I'm going to say my knowledge of Dick and most of the people I've known who've been acting is that they don't think that way. They're not businessmen. You know, their minds don't go that way. I was thinking about that before the show began tonight. My son spent many years in theater, and he knew and he still knows many actors. They're just different. They're a different breed of person, and I would never, you know, I love who they are. They're like a flame that you need to have that glows because they are so unique in what they are and what they do. And I just don't think people really understand what actors are, but I think I've always been around them for as long as I can remember. I'm not able to act. I mean, it would be nice, wouldn't it, to be in front of that camera. But
sure.
It's not easy. And I think what they're willing to undergo, the things they are willing to endure, I really admire actors. I really do. And
it can't be easy to be on stage and pretend you're this character, and you have to make the audience believe that you are that character and forget who they really are. And I think a lot of the, in the classic original movies, I think we saw a lot of that where, you know, people like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford made you totally forget they were an actor and actress. We really believe they were that person on the screen. And, you know, whether you hated them or loved them or, you know, the character, they truly made you believe that they were
Sometimes
that person.
Sometimes I get sad when I read the books that are so derogatory about these people because I think you just have to take a step back and understand what they were willing to do and how far they were willing to go. And I just truly, it is a craft. It truly is a craft, a great craft. And those that can make us stop and momentarily forget where we are and who we are, that's a unique gift. And so that's probably part of why I did the book too, because I thought he made 250 movies. Are we really just to turn the page and forget him?
Oh, that's wonderful that you did, because that you did write the book, because it's he made a mark in the world, and I think people who make a mark in the world should have their stories told. So I'm very pleased that you did write the book and share this information with the world. So what about the Gabors? You have a fascinating story.
Oh, yeah,
about
that's a
the
wonderful
Gabors.
Chapter. The Gabors are fascinating, right? I think one of the things that most people don't know is that they were Hungarian Jews. I didn't know that. They always wore big crosses, but they were. They escaped from Nazi Germany. Their father was a jeweler. He had 5 stores. They were quite wealthy, and by the time they left Nazi Hungary, they had nothing. They came into this country without anything. And the chapter is very interesting because when they got here, the mother realized all they had was their beauty, and they were beautiful, Zsa and Ava. But Ava was put to work first, and she obviously must have known about Dick. He was a big star at that time, and she approaches him. She comes to his bungalow, when he's making a film, and she approaches him, and she gets herself a part. And what I like is he's such a gentleman. He says by the time she left, she didn't want to, she came. He said, well, I'm on a break, and she said, that's all right, I'm staying. And by the time she left, she was a star, and as they say. And she did. She starred in that movie. But
that's
she
wonderful.
Went on, and she, yeah. So well, the funniest story is when they came, they lived with him. The chapter starts, and I love that, because they paid him back, and nobody ever paid him back for anything, because he was a very generous man when he had the money. And basically they lived with him at a period before she actually became an actress with a contract. They were absolutely poor. They had nothing, and he supported them, and they lived with him. And so they remained good friends, and she, of course, goes on. I think she was married 5 times, and Zsa was married 9 times. And so they were unique players.
Wow.
I know.
So here
wonderful.
They were. They were totally poor, escaping the Nazis, where they were wealthy before the Nazis invaded. And they end up in Hollywood, and they're dirt broke, and they are very vivacious. And also, you can see they're very bubbly. So they start talking to Richard Arlen, and boom, the next thing you know, they become movie stars.
Well,
helping them out.
Yeah.
And
I
so
think
they did pay
the
him back,
but
though, right?
He had,
didn't you say they paid him back? Didn't you say
they
paid him back?
They paid him back. They gave him.
That's amazing.
They took him out, and they gave him something like $5,000 or $6,000 back, paying him for that period of time when he completely supported them, and they lived with him. Until Ava got her first real contract, and then the family knew they would be safe and they would go on. And that's really how they began. And I don't know if anyone even knows that little piece of history. So he was very instrumental in their lives. And then the other really big story in there that I love is he was really good friends with Laurel and Hardy. And he went to England, and he appeared on the stage, and he just puts in the whole burlesque routine that they used to do. And I remember that routine, where they play doctor and nurse, and everybody gets on the stage, and everybody's underneath the sheet, and before you know it, you're underneath the sheet, and you're being operated on. And so it's a funny bit. And I always think of them as, if we want to think about who do we really think about from that era, I'm going to say it's Laurel and Hardy. And everyone today loves them still, their unique style of comedy, very much what I guess I would call comedy dell'arte, because, it was both slapstick and very sly and very clever and just wonderful, wonderful, and two sweet, kind gentlemen that, again, he stayed friends with until they died. So I love that quality in all his stories, that he was your friend. And the stories are not so much about Dick. The stories are about other people. I've read a number of stories of actors, and it's always about themselves. But after Dick writes about him, his childhood and his biography, once he gets into Hollywood, the stories are about other people. And that's fascinating, considering he's an actor.
It is fascinating. But in the end, didn't Hollywood end up with five major studios?
Yes, that's in the book, too, the five major studios. He writes about them and how they all began. And how, you know, but in the old days, I mean, you made 10 pictures a week. I mean, they made pictures everywhere. It's just really remarkable where we've evolved from, what we've come to. And it was an era. I guess they call it the golden era of Hollywood, because basically people were pretty innocent. They were trying to create something that would remain. And they certainly did, you know. And
yes,
I think it's
fantastic that you've given us some history about Hollywood and about how it began and how Wings began and how it became so popular, and as a silent movie, and how it projected the Air Force, you know, because we all love our military. And I don't think people really realize that, you know, back in those days, they actually used our Air Force, our Air Force pilots to make a movie. And
oh,
a
the
movie
whole picture
that lasted.
Done by other people. Yes, done by actual pilots and done by, they did hire some pilots, but we didn't have stuntmen. They didn't have people who did those things for a living. So they had to use the Air Force joined in. What was great for them was great advertising, because they were trying to create and build an Air Force. And what a wonderful introduction to the United States Air Force than this picture, which went all over the world.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the most important points in my personal view, you know, is because, you know, I mean, what better way to support and promote the United States Air Force, those great men, you know, who risked their lives. And so, yes, I really, you know, want to thank you for writing the book, Wings, and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. And as we're closing, it's your time to shine, and you can tell us any little short, brief tips you want about yourself, about your book, and if there's any events coming up, and how to get your book.
Well, my book's on Amazon, and it's in other bookstores, but it's easier you purchase through Amazon. I have to give, you know, I'm lazy. I think about the book, and I don't push it the way I should. But I'm so grateful to you for letting me do this, for letting the word get out there, because I guess I did the book about a year ago, and at first I thought of it, Rose, as just a tribute book to my mother, because she worked so hard and she was so in love with him, and to him, because he was so kind and gentle and nice and a gentleman. But as the time has evolved and changed, I begin to understand that I actually did a history book. I really didn't know I did, you know, and that what I've done is give a complete history of the making of that picture. You know, in 2012, Wellman Jr., I think, with Paramount, they decided to go full force, and they redid the picture. Now you can buy it on Blu-ray and DVD, and it's out there for everyone. And they don't want people to forget it. And I think there's a reason, because it was a monument in two ways. One, it's the end of silent film. Boy. And it's the beginning of making pictures in the air. Nobody had ever done that before. And think of what we are and where we are today and how things have changed. But there's always got to be a beginning. And that Wings is a monument and a testament to pilots, to planes, to people who understand that there's a trajectory in film in motion pictures, in the making of a picture. And Wings was one of the last great pictures ever of that era.
Yes, and it's like part of our history, you know, because Hollywood is part of our history. And I think it's really important to know all about our history, you know, for the youth to learn about how did all this come about. It didn't just happen by waving a magic wand. It was a lot of hard work. It was a lot of creativity. It was a lot of effort and sacrifice, I'm sure, for a lot of people. And, you know, so, you know, and I think a lot of people struggled making movies back then and trying to make a living at the same time. And I think it just represents our country and how the American people are so creative, just, you know, innovative, and how they end up on top. No matter what people say about our country, we always end up on top. And I just want to thank you for writing Winx and sharing these stories with us. And I hope everyone will get a copy from Amazon, Winx, and other recollections of early Hollywood by Judy Watson. And I want to thank you for being on Columbo Chronicles, Judy, and I wish you so much success, and hopefully you'll write another book and share it with the world.
Well, I'd like to write a book. I really was thinking about television, because I happened to have been married to a man who came into television when it was beginning. And KTLA, where he worked, was the largest commercial television station on the West Coast. They're the ones who did unfortunately, the atom bomb and all these other fabulous things without really knowing what they were doing. So again, it's the same kind of thing, you know, where it's you're going into something that's the evolution. Think about television, the evolution of television, and where we are today. And it's just mind-boggling to me, every bit of it, where we've come from.
That would be great, and we'll look forward to it. And thank you again, and I hope you have a really great evening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thank you, Rose. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye. Well, Judy Watson has left the building, and it was a very fascinating, quick interview. And now you know a little more history about Winx, the movie, and Hollywood, and some of the original movie stars with stories that had never been told, thanks to Judy Watson. So be sure to go to Amazon and get a copy of her book. And I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next Wednesday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. when Lloyd Wright will be our guest. He's an expert and an author on hepatitis C and the prescription drugs, and he's going to share some wonderful, wonderful information and educational information with you and me. So God bless you and God bless America, and this is Rose Colombo signing off. And wishing you a pleasant evening.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or, "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Columbo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Columbo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to columbochronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Columbo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColumboChronicles.com.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.